Good as were the profits to be had from flogging leather to the Persians, these were hardly likely to compensate, even in small part, for the loss of subsidies from Caesar's agents. The Arab tribes, who had emigrated northwards on the scent of Roman gold, and who had relied on their paymaster's lucre for decades, had grown much impoverished. Well then might the message proclaimed by the prophet, that he had a license from God to plunder unbelievers, have met with an enthusiastic uptake. Remember a time when you were few in number, and held to be weak on earth, when you feared men would tear you to pieces. He gave you refuge and aided you with his victory, and he bestowed his bounties upon you. Bounties that once, perhaps, Muhammad's followers would have been content to receive from the Roman authorities, but not any more. A wellspring that had run dry was no longer a wellspring at all. Here, then, was a crisis, and an attempt to resolve it, bred thoroughly of its time. The arc of its parabola can still just about be traced, discernible despite all the thick overlay applied centuries later by pious biographers and commentators. The Qur'an, far from standing at some fantastical remove from the currents and convulsions of the age, is the supreme monument to them. It is the record of a man living through an unprecedented period of upheaval, alert in every way he can be to the word of God, and betraying a sensibility, even as he contemplates the ruin of the universe itself, that is decidedly bookish. "That will be the day," so God says at one point in a description of the looming end times, "when we roll up the sky as a writer rolls up his scrolls." Such images, which occur throughout the Qur'an, suggest a man who was the polar opposite of illiterate, and who, even as he laid claim to traditions of divine inspiration that were immeasurably venerable, knew full well what he was doing. Such it was to be the seal of the prophets, a herald of good tidings, a bearer of warning. The good tidings provided a solution to humanity's troubles that did not depend upon mortal agency. The warning explained what would happen to those who closed their ears to it. But it was not enough for the prophet's message to be inscribed simply upon the souls of his audience. The evils of the time were as political as they were spiritual, and as economic as they were moral. Like the rabbis of Mesopotamia and Tiberias, like Justinian and his great team of jurists, the prophet appreciated that not only individuals, but society itself required moulding to the purposes of God. This was why, it seems, he set himself to the founding of a state, first among the Mushrikun, and then, in the wake of their rejection, among the Muhajirun. And its capital? Here, at any rate, there is no contradiction between the Qur'an and the great spider's web of subsequent Islamic tradition. A battle fought against overwhelming odds, a violent wind and invisible forces sent by God against the prophet's enemies, a glorious victory snatched from the jaws of defeat. All this, so the Qur'an records, occurred at a place that, for once, it actually names. Yathrib, that fertile oasis in the northern Hijaz, was indeed, it would appear, Madinat an-Nabi, the city of the prophet. Medina, just as tradition records, ranked as the very first bridgehead of the heavenly established by Muhammad on earth. Does that mean, then, that the story told of a single dramatic flight there, a hijra, is similarly based on fact? It is notable, certainly, that the word itself does not appear anywhere in the Qur'an, and, as with so many details of his biography, all references to the prophet's escape to Yathrib are frustratingly late in origin. Reason enough, then, perhaps, to be suspicious, and to wonder whether the whole notion of emigration might possibly have had a significance for the prophet and his followers that subsequent tradition has obscured. Memorable the story of the Hijra may be, and yet there seems to lurk behind it the hint of something much more seismic. In the Qur'an, emigration is cast as a duty incumbent upon all believers, no matter their circumstances, no matter their location. Far from alluding to a single journey into exile, whether to Yathrib or to anywhere else, it seems to imply a call to arms that is all-embracing, universal, and unbounded by time or place. Anyone who migrates for God's cause will find many a refuge and great plenty in the earth. Nothing could conceivably have sounded more radical or terrifying to the prophet's audience. Abandoning family and tribe was the most stomach-churning prospect imaginable for any Arab. And yet, if the Quran is to be trusted, this was precisely the commitment that the prophet was demanding. And not just of his own people, but of all the various descendants of Ishmael, wherever they might live, across the entire sweep of Arabia. The successful planting of his banner in Yathrib, set against the backdrop of the apparent breaking of the world, was to be only the start. All those with the courage, or perhaps the sheer desperation, to accept the prophet's challenge and embark on a new beginning, were invited to join him on a journey that might lead God alone knew where. And to be sure, whether they were tempted by heaven, plunder, or both, there was clearly no lack of Arabs who were prepared to answer the summons. You are the best community ever brought forth among mankind, commanding virtue and forbidding vice, and believing in God. So the prophet hailed the Muhajirun as a band of warriors who had it within them not only to found a whole new order of society, but to inherit, as their reward for doing so, the earth itself. A claim that was to be proved, and in short order, quite spectacularly correct. Why? Early in AD 634, alarming news reached Caesarea, the handsome city on the coast of Palestine that had long served as the hinterland's capital. A war band of Saracens, trespassing directly on Roman territory, had crossed into the Negev, and was now aiming northwards for the rich fields and villages of Samaria. A most tiresome intrusion, and one that the provincial authorities were naturally anxious to nip in the bud. No matter that the Roman military, in the wake of plague and war, remained extremely stretched, a task force of infantry, summoned hurriedly to arms, marched out into the open and swung briskly south. At their head, resplendent in the white uniform that marked him out as a personal favourite of the emperor, rode a patrician by the name of Sergius. He had particular cause to relish the challenge ahead. Already he had been looking to replenish the finances of the exhausted province by restricting the profits that Saracen merchants were permitted to take back across the frontier. Now, with the barbarians seemingly provoked to open larceny by this measure, it was time to reacquaint them with the brute facts of Roman might. The region's ancient mistress, after her temporary absence, was back. Sergius and his small army met the invaders in the afternoon of the 4th of February, some 12 miles east of Gaza. The result was utter debacle. The infantry were ambushed, and Sergius himself, having reputedly fallen 3 times from his horse, was taken prisoner. His fate, according to one report, was a peculiarly unpleasant one. Sewn up inside a freshly flayed camel hide, he was suffocated to death as the stinking skin dried out. Further calamities quickly followed. The Saracens, with devilish cunning, turned out to have launched a pincer movement against Palestine. The second warband, crossing the eastern frontier even as the first was rampaging through the Negev, joined exultantly in the scouring of the province. Over fields thick with thistles, weed-covered highways and crumbling walls they swept. Saracens, Roman strategists had always asserted with imperious complacency, are by nature unable to conduct sieges. But now, to the horror of the authorities, this reassurance was proving a worthless one. If it was cities, with their dense populations and rat-infested byways, that had always proved most vulnerable to the scythings of the plague, then the distinction between town and countryside, after whole decades of visitations, was one that had come increasingly to be blurred. Sheep grazed amid toppled pillars, while cattle, tethered against the depredations of bandits, spent their nights in abandoned shops and foundries. If the average city of Palestine was not yet wholly a ghost town, then it certainly had one foot in the grave. Unsurprisingly, then, in the wake of Sergius's defeat, and with Roman field armies nowhere to be seen, ambassadors from settlement after settlement sought to follow the path of least resistance and buy off the invaders. Not that many could seriously have thought that the Saracens would be around for long. As with Samaritan uprisings, so with incursions from the desert. The imperial authorities had seen it all before. Inveterately barbarian as the Saracens were, perhaps it was only to be expected that they would once in a while turn rogue. Back in 582, for instance, when Ghassanid resentment at the exile of their king had provoked the Foederati into open revolt, they had inflicted a crushing defeat on an imperial army in open battle, and then ranged at will across Syria. A couple of centuries before that, an Arab queen named Marvia, long celebrated in song by the Saracens, had launched a series of devastating raids that had taken her all the way to Egypt. The Roman response, on both occasions, had been the time-honoured one of dazzling the barbarians with bribes. Both Marvia and the Ghassanids, despite the undoubted scares that they had given the provincial authorities, had been successfully pacified with a whole range of exotic gewgaws. Golden furnishings and fancy titles had, as ever, proved their worth. No reason, then, for Heraclius to feel particularly perturbed by the defeat outside Gaza. Alarming though the swift return to warfare to Palestine clearly was, the Saracens hardly rivaled the Persians as foes. After all, if history had taught Roman officials anything, it was that the walls of Arabia, no matter how much of a passing threat they might be on occasion, could always be muzzled in the end. This latest invasion would prove very different, though. The Saracens did not content themselves with the extortion of subsidies and silken cloaks. Rather than wait to be graced with treasure from the hands of Caesar, they aimed instead to rip it brutally from his grasp. With Palestine effectively secured, they immediately flung themselves against the defences of Syria. 50 years later, a monk writing in Sinai would record what ensued. Two terrible battles, one at the Ghassanid camp city of Jibiah, and the other a few miles to the west on the Golan Heights above the river Yarmouk. The details are slight, and it is the measure of how impossible it has proved for historians to agree on the actual progress of the Arab invasion and the struggle of the Romans to resist it that not a single earlier reference to these fateful clashes exists in either Arabic or Greek. The dates, the details, and the course of the Syrian campaign all are veiled by contradiction and confusion. Nevertheless, if the particulars of what happened during the campaigning have defied repeated attempts to arrive at a consensus, then not so the result. For the Roman army, as the monk in Sinai would note with bleak finality, it proved a defeat as fatal as it was terrible. By late 636, with the campaigning season drawing to a close, Heraclius seems to have bowed to the inevitable. Burning villages and fields as he withdrew, he abandoned the very provinces that he had moved heaven and earth to retake just a few years previously. "Peace be upon you, Syria," he is said to have cried, as he paused for one last yearning look back. "What a rich country is this for the enemy!" Yet others were richer still. Across the desert from Syria, where the humiliating collapse of the House of Sasan into debilitation and factionalism had brought a beardless king by the name of Yazdegerd to the throne, Iranshar itself was no less exhausted and divided than its royal family. The marks of the Roman invasion still scarred the landscape. The river Tigris, having burst its banks in AD 629, had swept away an immense swathe of irrigation works and left Kharvad's great canals silted up. Parthian warlords, snarling and snapping as ever, now threatened the entire fabric of the imperial high command with disintegration. Never, not even in the dark days following the death of Peroz, had the empire been so enfeebled. And the Arabs, alert as they were to the sense of weakness, well knew it. Either a few weeks or a few years after the Roman defeat at the Yarmouk, the sources, as usual, are at sixes and sevens, a similarly decisive battle was fought on Iran Shah's desert flank. Qadisiyya was a small palm-fringed town just to the south of the one-time Lakhmid capital of Hira. Now it would be the scene of an epically terminal disaster for Iran Shah. After fighting that spanned several days, and the failure of elephants as well as the Persian heavy cavalry to turn the tide, the Arabs emerged triumphant. Their women, stalking the palm groves, were said to have busied themselves slitting the throats of those of the enemy still left there alive. Meanwhile, the exultant Arab army, pursuing the remnants of their defeated foes across canals and pontoon bridges, caught up with the fugitives amid the ruins of Babylon and briskly wiped them out. Iran Shah had been decapitated, for all the leading nobles were killed. Ctesiphon, a bare 100 miles to the north, now lay directly in the Arabs' path. Its fall, with the flower of the empire's chivalry left blackened and rotting in the killing fields of the south, was only a matter of time. Sure enough, despite bitter resistance that seems to have lasted almost a year, the great city was duly stormed. Yazdegerd himself, amid much confusion, managed to escape his doomed capital, zigzagging across the mudflats in a desperate effort to evade his pursuers. He finally reached the relative security of the Iranian uplands and his ancestral hometown of Istakhr, from which Ardashir, 5 centuries previously, had embarked on his own great project of conquest. But the royal regalia and the imperial treasury, all were lost. So too was Mesopotamia, which the invaders, in imitation of the Persians, knew by the name of Iraq. That Arab fingers could prod at the crown worn by Khusro the Great, that Arab feet could tread on carpets from the royal palace, woven with gold and adorned with precious stones, that Arab prayers could be heard in the great throne room of Ctesiphon, from the sides of which statues of Yazdegerd's ancestors gazed out stern and impassive, oblivious to the ruin that engulfed the house of Sasan. All this, in the opinion of the Arabs themselves, taught a lesson so edifying that they would never tire of repeating it. The coin of contempt dealt them for so long by Caesar and Shahanshah alike had been richly, deliciously repaid. 2.5 centuries on from Qadisiyya, by which time the Muslims ruled an empire even vaster than Khusro the Great's, their pride in having scorned superpower dazzle could still rank for them as the surest measure of their dignity. In the past, those of us who came to you were obedient to you. They humbled themselves before you. They sought what was in your hands. So one Arab, as pious as he was lacking in personal hygiene, was supposed to have told the silken Persians on the eve of the great battle. But now we no longer come to you looking for the things of this world. Our desire and aspiration is for paradise. Hairy, badly dressed, and stinking of camel as he was, this ambassador to the perfumed tents of the Persian High Command would be commemorated in histories of the conquest as the heroic embodiment of Muslim brotherhood. God loves not the swaggering and the conceited, so the Prophet had taught. Even though, if tradition is to be trusted, Muhammad died in 632, 2 whole years before the first rubbing of a superpower nose in the dirt, it was his revelations of a God who humbles the proud and slaughters them in battle and permits them to be despoiled of all their goods that had given the Arabs the courage and sheer self-confidence to go eyeball to eyeball with their former masters. Riding in to meet Roman or Persian officials, their ambassadors were said to have made a point of trampling down their cushions and stabbing with spears at their carpets. The conquest of the world and the scorning of its seductions, such, it seemed to Muslim historians writing centuries later, had been the supreme achievement of the generation that had known Muhammad. It had one supreme exemplar. Umar bin al-Khattab had ranked as the most formidable and domineering of all the Prophet's companions, the leader under whose guidance both Syria and Iraq had been won, the veritable sword arm of the Prophet. Tradition would commemorate him not merely as a great emir, commander, but as something very much more, as a Muslim so flame-lit by his knowledge of God's will that several Quranic verses were said to have been revealed purely to provide his opinions with some heavenly backup. Even Muhammad, according to certain traditions, had acknowledged that Umar was the better Muslim of the two. "When people differ on any issue," one celebrated ruling declared, "look for Umar's doing, and abide by it." Like the Quran itself, then, the character of the second caliph was a book in which might be read the lessons of God's will. Mighty warrior and mighty ascetic, quick to draw his sword and no less quick to trample down in righteous scorn the luxuries won by that same sword, a man who, from his mudbrick home in Medina, could direct the overthrow of mighty empires, and yet who, if he saw his lieutenants dressed in silks and brocade, would leap down from his saddle and pelt them with stones. Such, in the opinion of Muslim scholars, was the man who had secured the world for Islam. A plausible characterization? Certainly, as with Muhammad, so with Umar. His historicity is beyond dispute. An Armenian bishop, writing a decade or so after Qadisiyya, described Umar in a brief throwaway sentence, much as Muslim historians would subsequently do, as a mighty potentate coordinating the advance of the sons of Ishmael from the depths of the desert. Nor is that all. There do indeed seem to be found, preserved in the traditions that Muslims would record of the Shahaba, the companions of Muhammad, authentic echoes of the God-haunted and strife-torn age that had witnessed the Futuh, the conquest. If there seems no reason to doubt that Umar, that model of ferocious piety, was directly inspired by the awesome thunder of the Prophet's revelations, then so too is it evident that the Prophet himself, in his summoning of the Arabs to holy war, was perfectly in accord with the spirit of the times. In truth, he informed his followers, the punishment of those who make war against God and his messenger, and roam the earth corrupting it, is that they be killed, or crucified, or have their hands and feet amputated, alternately, or be exiled from the land. Such a message was all the more resonant, no doubt, for being delivered direct from the Almighty himself, and yet the sentiments informing it would have been instantly recognizable to anyone familiar with the workings of Roman power. Whether it was Justinian breaking the rebellious Samaritans, or Saint Simeon incinerating Mundhir with a fireball, or Heraclius bringing ruin to the fire temples of the Persians, examples were hardly lacking of spectacular violence committed in the cause of God. Umar, turning the pretensions of the Christian empire back upon itself, seemed to those he conquered, as well as to those he commanded, a warlord of a thoroughly recognizable kind. What added incomparably to his prestige, however, and did truly suggest something novel, was that his earth-shaking qualities as a generalissimo were combined with a most distinctive cast of virtue. Rather than ape the manners of a Caesar, as the Ghassanid kings had done, he drew on the example of a quite different kind of Christian. Umar's threadbare robes, his diet of bread, salt, and water, and his rejection of worldly riches would have reminded anyone from the desert reaches beyond Palestine of a very particular kind of person. Monks, out in the Judean desert, had long been casting themselves as warriors of God. The achievement of Umar was to take such language to a literal and previously unimagined extreme. Just like the Quran itself, then, the heroic stories that were told of the second caliph seemed to reach back to a specific place and moment, to the fringes of Palestine and that terrifying period of superpower conflict when it appeared that the world itself stood in the shadow of the end days. That war might be waged in the name of God, and that a contempt for earthly pleasures too was a form of warfare, these twin presumptions, which Umar embodied in a supremely radical way, were nevertheless far from being original to him. Naturally, the truth of this cannot help but be obscured by histories that locate his beginnings, like those of the prophet himself, in a desert backwater many hundreds of miles from the Fertile Crescent. Composed centuries later by men of intense piety who could feel God nearer to them than their jugular veins, it's no wonder that such narratives, like sandstone shaped by ceaseless weathering, should have been transformed out of recognition over the course of the generations. Hence, in trying to explain how a state came to be forged in the depths of Arabia formidable enough to subdue the Fertile Crescent, the perennial frustration. The aftermath of the conquests masterminded by Umar could hardly be more manifest. But not so the course, and still less the cause, of the original eruption. Which said, despair need not be total. There has been preserved, embedded within the vast corpus of subsequent writings on the prophet, at least a single lump of magma sufficiently calcified to have stood proof against all erosion. The Constitution of Medina, it has been termed, a series of 8 brief treaties, concluded between the Muhajirun and the natives of Yathrib, and which, not least because they refer to the emigrants as believers rather than Muslims, are accepted by even the most suspicious of scholars as deriving from the time of Muhammad. Here, in these precious documents, it is possible to glimpse the authentic beginnings of a movement that would succeed in barely 2 decades in prostrating both the new Rome and Iran Shah. That the prophet consciously aimed at state-building, that it was his ambition to forge his own people and the local Arab tribes into a single Ummah, that this confederation was to fight in the path of God. These brief details, the veritable building blocks out of which all the much later stories of Muhammad's life would be constructed, do authentically seem rock solid. What the Constitution of Medina does not tell us, however, is where the Muhajirun had originally come from, nor does it reveal precisely whom they felt called upon by God to fight. Most regrettably of all, it sheds no light on how an alliance stitched together in a remote oasis might conceivably have expanded to embrace the whole of Arabia, and then to take on the world. Nevertheless, its very existence would seem to suggest that the hard core of Muslim tradition may truly derive from the time of Muhammad, and have stood proof, after all, against the weathering effects of time. Conflict between the upstart Ummah and the Quraysh, eventual compromise on both sides, and the agreement between them of a treaty, a brutal crushing of the new confederation of any Arab tribes bold enough to stand in its way, such a process of state-building seems, at the very least, plausible. And if accurate, then it would imply that there may perhaps be other clues, preserved in the stories told centuries later of the prophet's career, as to how and why, as if from the blue, the imperial authorities in both Syria and Iraq were overwhelmed by precisely the kind of Arab federation that hitherto had always been theirs to sway. Even though Muslim tradition would cast the conflict between Muhammad and the Quraysh as a struggle for control of Mecca, this tradition itself contains hints of a suggestively alternative one. Particularly striking, for instance, is the number of leading Qurayshi dynasts who, despite supposedly being based in Mecca, are said to have purchased estates in Syria during the prophet's lifetime. An example of long-distance property speculation which, if genuinely conducted from the Hejaz, would have had no precedent in the entire span of Roman history. Previously, whether along the Rhine or in Armenia, the only barbarians who owned land on either side of the imperial frontier were those who directly bordered it, all of which would seem to imply a rather awkward conundrum. Either the Quraysh truly came from Mecca, in which case they could not have owned property in Roman territory, or else they owned property in Roman territory, in which case they are most unlikely to have come from Mecca. Of these two alternatives, it's clear that the second is the likelier. Even on the evidence of Muslim tradition itself, the obsession of the Prophet with securing the border zone south of Palestine is manifest. With the single exception of Mecca itself, all the targets of his campaigning, all the objects of his military ambitions, are said to have lain in this region, the stretches of desert that the Romans' Arab allies had always traditionally patrolled. If the Quraysh did go from attempting to strangle the Prophet's infant confederation in its cradle to allying themselves with it, and there seems no reason to doubt it, they would obviously have been putting their stake in any imperial sanctioned order in serious jeopardy. This, however, at a time when the supply of gold from Caesar had long since dried up, seems to have struck them as a gamble well worth taking. The winnings on offer, after all, were potentially dazzling. It was not only the plunder promised them by Muhammad's terrifyingly omnipotent god that would have glimmered in the imaginings of the Qurayshi leaders. So too would something even more seductive, the prospect of toppling the Ghassanids, of laying claim to the heritage of the Lakhmids, of fashioning a whole new Shirkat, with themselves as the region's top dogs. What the new confederation of Muhajirun and Quraysh appears initially to have aimed at, as their primary strategic goal, was the mastery of the Syrian desert. That it ended up conquering Syria itself, and Mesopotamia too, may well then have come as big a surprise to its leaders as it did to the Romans and Persians themselves. It certainly seems no coincidence that the invaders' two most decisive victories were won on the doorsteps of two places that had long featured prominently in Arab dreams. For generations, the tales told of the courts of Jabiya and Hira and the songs sung of their splendours had haunted the imaginings of the desert tribes. Now, with the defeat of the Romans at the Yarmouk, calamity had overwhelmed their Ghassanid clients as well, just as the shattering of the Persian monarchy at Qadisiyya had spelled doom for all those local desert chieftains with fantasies of sitting on the vacant throne of the Lakhmids. The likelihood is, in fact, that both imperial armies, as they sought to stem the Saracen onslaught, consisted themselves, in large part, of Arab tribesmen. Muslim historians, not surprisingly, would take an exultant delight in emphasizing the immensity of the manpower available to the toppled empires, of how their troops numbered in the hundreds of thousands, and of how their blood, when it was spilled, had flowed in such prodigious quantities as to turn the wheels of local water mills. Contemporaries knew better, though. They understood the true condition of anemia that had afflicted both superpowers. Heraclius, as one bishop bluntly put it, could raise no more troops to oppose the Ishmaelites. Given the absence of regular troops, he had no alternative but to rely on foederati to defend Roman territory. The Ghassanids, and all the other tribes allied to them, repaid Heraclius's trust with fierce loyalty. But it ensured, when the Muhajirun first appeared across the Syrian desert, that the Roman military itself was reduced to something of a sideshow. Almost a century of pestilence and whole decades of war, these, in their combined effects, had left the emperor with no clothes. So it was that Syria and Palestine slipped away a second time from the grasp of the new Rome, and those Qurayshis, who had previously held estates under the sufferance of the imperial authorities, now took possession of entire provinces. But they were not alone, of course, in claiming title deeds to the Holy Land, as the defeated Christians, in their bewilderment and demoralization, were all too bitterly aware. Torn between blaming the calamities that had overwhelmed them on either their own sinfulness or the machinations of the Jews, many, not surprisingly, plumped for the latter option. Was it any coincidence, they wondered, that the horror of the invasion of the Ishmaelites should have followed so fast upon Heraclius's campaign of forced baptisms? Dark rumours began to swirl of how Jewish refugees from this decree had fled to Arabia, of how, upon their arrival in the desert, they had turned the head of the Saracens with honeyed talk of their shared descent from Abraham, of how Muhammad, looking to claim their birthright, had duly set off at their head to conquer Palestine. Stories such as these, of course, were prone only to grow wilder with the telling, and yet the wildest rumours of all, perhaps, were the very earliest. Back in 634, with Sergius freshly entombed in his shroud of camel skin, fabulous reports of a Saracen prophet had swept through Caesarea. By Christians, of course, he had been scorned as the rankest impostor. For since when did prophets come armed with a sword? Among the Jews of the city, however, the reaction had been very different. Delight, no doubt, would have been their response to any Roman defeat, but their joy, in that spring of 634, had been blended with a fierce and familiar hope. People were saying that the prophet had appeared, coming with the Saracens. And his message? They say that he is proclaiming the advent of the Anointed One, the Christ who is to come. It was exactly 20 years since Nehemiah, amid a similar groundswell of excitement, had sought to rebuild Jerusalem's temple, and promptly been impaled for his pains. To the Jews of Palestine, though, the Ishmaelites must have seemed altogether more promising agents of deliverance than the Persians had ever been. They might have been wild asses among men, but they were at least distant cousins. Then there was the fact that the prophet himself, or so it would seem, had chosen Moses as his particular role model. O people, enter the Holy Land which God has marked out for you, and do not go back to your old ways, only to end up as losers. Any Jews hearing Muhammad attribute this exhortation to their greatest prophet, the original rabbi, the man who had led them out of bondage and back to the Promised Land, might well have pricked up their ears. Indeed, some might well have done a good deal more than that. Such, at any rate, is the evidence of the constitution of Medina. Muhajirun, and local Arabs, it seems, were not alone in having ranked as original members of the Ummah. Also listed as believers, and graced with a starring role in the founding document of their state, had been some other, perhaps rather more unexpected enthusiasts for the prophet. Whole quantities of Jews. Later Muslim historians, clearly discombobulated by this, would attempt to explain them away as members of three Jewish clans supposedly native to Medina, who were said initially to have given their backing to the prophet, and then, after turning fractious, to have been variously driven into exile or massacred and dumped into pits. Yet there are serious difficulties in accepting this tradition as true. It's not simply that the three Jewish clans mentioned by the historians do not feature anywhere in the constitution of Medina. There is also another and familiar problem, that our only sources for the annihilation of these Jews are all suspiciously late. Not only that, but they date from the heyday of Muslim greatness, a period when the authors would have had every interest in fabricating the sanction of the prophet for the brusque slapping down of uppity infidels. Certainly, if it were truly the case that entire communities of Jews had been expelled into the desert or else wiped out by Ishmaelites in a bloodbath, then no contemporary seems to have noted it. This at a time when Jews, just like Christians, had never been more alert to the propaganda value of martyrs, is most peculiar. So peculiar, in fact, as to appear downright implausible. Far likelier, it would seem, is that the compact recorded in the constitution of Medina between the Muhajirun and assorted bands of Jewish warriors had held firm, and that it had culminated in the conquest of Palestine. Christians, when they fingered their old enemies as the tutors of Muhammad, were undoubtedly indulging themselves in a familiar paranoia, but less so, perhaps, when they accused the sons of Israel of joining with the Arabs to form a large army. Venerable the scorn of the Jews for the Ishmaelites may have been, but it was nothing like so savage as their loathing for the Romans. "Do not fear, son of man," so an angel was supposed to have reassured a twitchy rabbi. "The Almighty only brings the kingdom of Ishmael in order to deliver you from the wicked ones." In the first disorienting flush of the Ishmaelite occupation, Such a reassurance might well have seemed a perfectly convincing one. How else, after all, was the humiliation of Heraclius to be interpreted, if not as a deliverance ordained of God? Unsurprisingly, then, in the wake of the Jews' redemption from the threat of forced baptism, their enthusiasm for the new order seems to have flared with some flamboyance, and to have had a familiar focus. Jerusalem, that perennial object of Jewish longing, had been lost to the Romans along with the rest of the Holy Land. The Arabs, who in a curious show of antiquarianism insisted on calling it Elia, after its old pagan name of Aelia Capitolina, were quick to mark it with their own stamp. To Christian horror, the ancient ban on Jews entering the city's sacred limits, which dated back to the heyday of the pagan empire and which Heraclius had pointedly renewed, was revoked. Work also began on clearing rubble and refuse from the holiest Jewish spot of all, the Temple Mount. No surprise, then, that Umar, the second king who arises from Ishmael, and the man who had given the order, should have been hailed in breathless tones by one rabbi as a lover of Israel. As the work continued, first with the levelling of the bedrock, and then with the cannibalization of the Capitolian, the Temple of Jupiter, there were some Jews who dared to go even further and dreamed that it was the temple itself being rebuilt. No prospect could possibly have been more dazzling. With the temple restored, after all, there would arise a new Israel. Inevitably, then, the excited rumours prompted by the defeat of Sergius at Gaza, of the Messiah's imminent arrival, continued to swirl. Time, it was true, would prove this optimism sorely misplaced. The more extravagant hopes of the Jews were destined, as ever, to be disappointed. The temple was not restored. The Messiah did not appear hot on the heels of the Ishmaelites' prophet. Nevertheless, there was, in the febrile speculations of the Jews, something more than mere wishful thinking. Those who sensed in the Ishmaelites a particular obsession with the Promised Land were surely not mistaken. Just as Gibeah and Hira had been the initial objects of the conqueror's strategic ambitions, Palestine had clearly blazed in their imaginings as a prize that transcended mere earthly considerations. Although it had been a simple matter for them to cross the undefended frontier into what the prophet had termed the Holy Land, ease of access had hardly been the primary consideration. God had promised Palestine to the descendants of Abraham, and so it had come to pass. No wonder, then, that in the immediate wake of the conquest, that Muhajirun, as well as Jews, appear to have indulged in any number of wild surmises. Indeed, on occasion it might be hard to tell them apart. Amid the general fracturing of the times, old identities and old certainties had the potential to warp very quickly. When Jews, praising Umar for his scouring of the Romans from Jerusalem and his cleansing of the Temple Mount, hailed him as the Messiah, there were certain Muhajirun who did not think to scorn the notion. Instead, caught up in the mood of excitement, they surrendered to it. Umar, so it was boldly proclaimed, ranked as none other than Al-Farouq, the Redeemer. Such, it appeared, was the true potency of the Temple Mount, that it could persuade Arabs to share in the fantasies of Jews. And perhaps, had the Muhajirun rested content with their conquest of the Holy Land and not set their horizons far wider, then their faith might ultimately have mutated into something truly messianic, a Jerusalem-haunted blurring of Jewish beliefs and the prophet's revelations. Yet already, even as Umar's workmen set to work on clearing the rubbish from the Temple Mount, it was apparent that Palestine, no matter how awesome a prize, provided far too small a stage for the evolving pretensions of the conquerors. What value the Promised Land, after all, when God had graced the Muhajirun with so much more besides? A question fit, perhaps, to perplex the conquerors themselves. Certainly, there had been nothing in the prophet's revelations to forewarn them that they might end up the masters of the world. Muhammad himself, when reporting God's assurance that he would settle the Muhajirun in a good abode, had seemed to take for granted that this same good abode was merely their inheritance from Abraham. The limits of his ambitions, it would appear, had been Arabia and Palestine. Yet both, in the event, had provided merely stepping stones, as too, in due course, would the entire glittering sweep of Syria and Iraq. Fabulous surprise though the Fertile Crescent was, infinitely beyond the dreams of previous generations of Arabs, it ultimately served only to whet the appetite of the Muhajirun for more. The world lay all before them, and God, it seemed, intended them to take it. So it was in late 639 that a tiny warband of Arabs, following the high road that led south from Gaza, crossed into Egypt. The breadbasket of Constantinople, most precious of all the various territories retrieved by Heraclius from Persian occupation, the province had been back under imperial rule for a decade, but not contentedly so. The return of Roman administrators had seen the return as well to the determinedly Monophysite province of a Chalcedonian patriarch. Heraclius, no less determined than Justinian had been to secure the unity of the church, had sponsored a program of increasingly repressive bullying. The Copts, digging in their heels, had responded by embracing every opportunity to pose as martyrs. The brother of the Monophysite patriarch, for instance, despite having his flanks griddled over a fire and his teeth pulled out, proved so obdurate in his defiance that the Chalcedonians, giving up on their attempts to convert him, had him dumped out at sea. Or so the story went. Certainly, the fact that so many Monophysites could swap such a rumour and believe it to be true reflected a groundswell of hostility to Constantinople that would ultimately prove fatal to Roman rule. Imperial exhaustion, Arab self-confidence, and the studied neutrality of the vast majority of the native population all contributed to the Muhajirun winning their most glittering prize yet. In September 642, after the expiration of an 11th-month armistice and a wholesale evacuation of the province by the Roman forces, the new lords of the Nile entered Alexandria. The disaster, so a Monophysite bishop piously declared, had been entirely due to the wickedness of the emperor Heraclius and his persecutions. If so, then God had exacted a high price. There were to be no more grain ships sailing from Alexandria to Constantinople. Meanwhile, the demand slapped on the city fathers of Heracleopolis for 65 sheep was an early indication of what the toppling of Roman rule might mean for those Christian officials left behind in Egypt. The Majaritae, the Muhajirun, still thought instinctively, as their ancestors had ever done, in terms of plunder and rustled livestock. Even when clattering down marble-paved high streets, past palaces and cathedrals, they retained instincts bred of the desert. Great cities such as Alexandria and Ctesiphon, for all the fabulous wealth that they promised, were viewed with dark suspicion, as breeding grounds of pestilence and black magic. Just as their forefathers had done when making their own hijra northwards from the depths of Arabia to serve Caesar or Shahanshah, the Muhajirun preferred to settle amid open fields, where they could live among their own kind and graze their sheep. Above all, they aimed to revel in the pleasures and the profits that war, by venerable tradition, had most honourably provided the Arabs. No wonder, then, that the settlements in which they congregated should fast have developed the character of garrison towns. In Iraq, where the unconquered uplands of Iran beckoned tantalizingly, two particularly large cities of tents and reed huts were soon sprouting among the mudflats. One, Basra, lay in the far south, near where the Tigris and Euphrates met with the sea. The other, Kufa, stood across the palm groves from the God-blessed site of Qadisiyah. Regularly, in the decade that followed the fall of Alexandria, Muhajirun, from these two bases, would ride out eastwards, embarked upon a fresh and far more challenging project of conquest. Persia, in marked contrast to Egypt, was a land of mountains and defiant citadels. Unremitting in a way that none of the previous campaigns of the Muhajirun had been, and subjugation of the Sasanian heartlands was to prove a brutal one. Although certainly marked by some lucrative gains, including the capture of yet more royal treasure and the body of the prophet Daniel, no less, it was only in 650, after a grinding 5-year campaign, that Istakhr was finally stormed. Although Yazdegerd once again made good his escape, the rest of the population were not so lucky. 40,000 in all were put to the sword, and the monuments and fire temples of Ardashir's city left a smoking rubble. No such calamity had been visited upon Persia since the time of Alexander and the burning of Persepolis. And in truth, with triumphs everywhere being recorded for Arab arms, the prospect shimmered before the victors of winning an empire even more vast than Alexander's. Yet greatness, for all the plunder and the glory that it had brought the Muhajirun, was not without its challenges. That God had favoured them, and humbled their enemies, was obvious enough to everyone, conquerors and conquered alike. That God fully intended the Muhajirun to enjoy the profits of their victories was also, to the Muhajirun themselves at any rate, no less self-evident. Even as the tide of warfare and ready plunder rolled ever onwards to the limits of east and west, the extortion of tribute ensured that the already subjugated lands would continue to turn a profit. It was true, of course, that such a pension scheme was bound to depend upon skills that were not readily associated with warriors on camels, but bureaucrats, as the town fathers of Heracleopolis had efficiently demonstrated, were hardly lacking in the conquered territories. Indeed, so remorseless had been the tax machines of both the New Rome and Iran Shah, that despairing Christians had long taken for granted that it would take the return of Christ to ease their exactions. By that reckoning, at any rate, the arrival of the Ishmaelites did not presage the end days. Officials of the two decapitated superpowers, seasoned as they were in the arts of extortion and eager to maintain their positions of authority, had every incentive to work hard for their new masters. Vast and implacable, like a kraken of the deep, undisturbed by storms raging across the ocean surface, the apparatus of empire still coiled its prodigious tentacles, ready to flex and squeeze its victims tightly, as it had ever done. Such was the beast that had served Justinian, the beast that had served Khusro the Great. What more awesome proof of God's power and mercy, then, than that he should have delivered it up into the hands of a leader such as Umar, a man so contemptuous of worldly rank that on inscriptions he might very well be name-checked without any title at all. Naturally, as Amir of the faithful, their commander, he was due their obedience, but hardly their grovelling. The stern message of the prophet, that all his followers were brothers, made a mockery of any notion, such as the people of the conquered territories were prone to take for granted, that Umar might rank as their king. His right to all the prodigious wealth won by the Muhajirun lay precisely in the fact that he so palpably scorned it. What is virtue? So the prophet had insistently demanded. Umar, conqueror of the known world though he might be, never disdained to illustrate the answer. Who dispenses money, though dear, to kinsmen, orphans, the needy, the traveller, the beggars, and for ransom? Who performs the prayer and pays the alms? Who fulfil their contracts when they contract? Who are steadfast in hardship, calamity, and danger? These are the true believers. These are truly pious. Yet as the years passed and the expanse of sword-won lands continued to increase, so memories of the prophet inevitably grew less immediate, and the value of his example more problematic. In 644, 10 years into the great adventure of the Arab conquests, Umar was murdered by a deranged Persian slave, and the faithful, in their search for a new commander, found themselves torn two ways. Their eventual choice, a man named Uthman, might have seemed the perfect continuity candidate. For tradition, and there seems no reason to doubt it, identifies him as one of the Prophet's earliest and most pious companions. Yet he also had the unmistakable whiff of a dynast, a man sprung from a family that was perfectly at ease with power and wealth. The Umayyads, according to Muslim historians, were Qurayshis who had made a fortune trading with the Romans and had invested it in Syrian real estate, a tradition that would seem to indicate an origin not in the depths of Arabia, but somewhere along the imperial frontier. Certainly, they had enjoyed a track record of success during the conquest of the region that might well have suggested local knowledge. One brother, Yazid, is said to have ranged with a warband far and wide across the province, while another, Muawiyah, had captured Caesarea and been appointed governor of Syria by Umar. Uthman not only confirmed him in this role, but also, in a blatant display of nepotism, made sure to promote other members of his family to similarly lucrative posts. Understandably, then, the Umayyads first gained a reputation for quite spectacular greed. One nephew, a smooth opportunist by the name of Marwan, developed a particular name for insatiability. No sooner had he been graced with 100,000 silver coins by Uthman than he was off to North Africa, where he proved as effective at screwing the natives out of their wealth as he was shameless in monopolizing the plunder. A second Umar, he most decidedly was not. None of which, it went without saying, reflected well on the new Amir himself. Yet there was worse. Uthman, unlike Umar, was not content to divide up the loot of empires in the time-honored manner of a bandit chieftain sharing out plunder after a successful raid. The Arabs, so it seemed to the new Amir, had moved on from that. The conquerors, if they were to make best use of the defeated superpower's bureaucracies, would themselves have to accept certain disciplines, a centralized administration, not least, and a clear-cut chain of command. Precisely the marks of slavery, in short, that the desert Arabs had always derided. No wonder, then, as Uthman sat in Medina and struggled to fashion his immense agglomeration of provinces into a properly imperial administration, that God, in the words of an Armenian bishop, should have sent a disturbance among the armies of the sons of Ishmael, so that their unity was split. In 656, a band of Muhajirun in Egypt, resentful of a newly appointed placeman, travelled back to Arabia to complain to the Amir in person. Uthman, taken by surprise, pretended to meet their grievances, but was then caught red-handed going back on his assurances. The Egyptians, outraged by his double-dealing, laid siege to his house, stormed it, and hacked him to death. Here, after all the noble talk of brotherhood that had animated the Muhajirun since their first emigration to Medina, was an abrupt reversion to a far more primordial way of conducting affairs. Uthman's widow, so tradition had it, dispatched her husband's blood-stained robe to Muawiyah in Syria, together with a pointed quotation from the Prophet, "Fight the oppressors until they submit to God's command." In truth, though, it needed no divine revelation to prompt the Umayyads to seek revenge. Nothing to an Arab warlord came more instinctively than a blood feud. That the Prophet had sternly warned against precisely such brawling seems to have inhibited Muawiyah not in the slightest. In Syria, the sense of community that had supposedly obliterated all distinctions between the Quraysh and the Muhajirun was glaring by its absence. There, in contrast to Iraq and Egypt, there had been no great influx of settlers, no sudden rash of garrison towns. Even